Cool Keith and Old Dirty for Mankind.
Yeah! Yeah! And this is gonna be done for everything!
2000 texture, rhyming with Old Dirty with my New York Jets jersey. Left lineman coming in like Mankind with diamonds sparkling around my rhymes. Black Levi's, suits, bloody caps and boots, wigs with Grecian formula, got us warning ya, with back slaps we put on Mac caps, sitting VIP with blind man looking like Stevie, we nasty, sitting next to Regis and Kathy, front row seats with blowfly, the crowd is so high, tickets with popcorn, we rock born, no circus here, just horses and a unicorn, tuxedos and taxis, we roll with leather maxis, catch the back breeze, gypsy cats burn rubber, signing autographs for Danny Glover, Donny Osmond and Dennis Rodman, up in an empty furniture apartment. With Mexican maids rubbing the spots off the carpet, we move and face our targets.
Punch, kick, fight, fight. Whatever you do, just kick ass. Cause I'm much different from the other MCs. Cause I got the amazing abilities. I can rock on the mic so you can have a ball. I can fly through the air, stick to the wall.
And joining us right now is Mick Foley. You know him better as Mankind and Cactus Jack from the WWF, which is now the WWE. And he's, of course, a writer and now a novelist. But I want to talk a little bit about the wrestling first, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind. But are you sure that your listeners know me as a wrestler or anything?
I think many of them do.
Good.
And in fact, there's been quite a reaction from folks that you're coming on.
Well, I'm excited to hear that.
Mankind had quite a following.
Yes. That was a character. I've been Cactus Jack for 11 years and didn't think that it needed any fixing. But I found out later that Vince McMahon did not think that I looked like a star. He actually thought I looked kind of sleazy. And so, I didn't understand at the time that Mankind was an attempt to cover up my face so that fans would not be subjected to it. But it did, in the long run, it turned out to be the best thing that could have happened to me.
I think one of the great things, you know, I talk all the time with celebrities in all different fields, and some of the most fun ones are the ones who do, like, cartoons, because no one knows what they look like, but they're wicked famous, like the SpongeBob SquarePants guy. Well, hey, you created this huge character. And a lot of people, when you were walking down the street, didn't recognize you. That must be the best of both worlds.
Well, initially, that was the way it was. That the only people who knew who I was when I went to the WWF were Cactus Jack fans from a couple of years earlier. And to tell you the truth, there weren't that many of them. Maybe a quarter of the people knew who I was. And so I did have a chance to mold not only a new identity, but to kind of be incognito, that I wouldn't get bothered that much. And then, in 98, wrestling just exploded. And, I had taken off the mask by that point. And even when I would put it back on, you know, the fans started referring to me by my real name, which was different, because that's not something that fans usually jumped on. And to most of the people, I just became known as Mick Foley.
Now, did things change a little bit when your name became well-known?
Yeah, it was amazing in that, for example, back in like 92 or 93, I could kind of gauge my career, how well things were going, by how often I was recognized at the Waffle House. You know, like if you went two times in a row without being recognized, you know, you were in trouble. And then, you know, 98 and 99, it was literally like being, one of the Backstreet Boys without Backstreet Boys security or financial compensation. But
right.
And it was a little harder to go incognito when you were 6'4 and 300 and it had a very unique walk and body shape.
I would assume at that point, though, that you were making some good money.
The money did start coming in 97. Started getting better than I ever thought it would. And I used to say, well, you know, we don't get paid as much as a baseball player, and then I saw the Minnesota Twins roster, you know, a few years ago, and I thought, okay, maybe I do make as much as a baseball player. And then in 99, when the autobiography came out and did so well, certainly better than anybody, myself included, could have ever dreamed, at that point, you know, it did become very lucrative.
And, of course, the follow-up, once you have your second book coming out, they know it's going to be successful. They pay you more.
Well, not in my case.
No?
That was one of the reasons why I left WWE. Is I just thought, hey, I know you guys got a big advance. It seems only appropriate to share it with me. I'm the guy who writes the book, And that was just a policy they had, that all those things were considered wrestling royalties. And it was strange in that at the same time when my career had never been bigger, and at the same time when this book had kind of taken the literary world by storm, I was actually more uptight than I had ever been, because this book was considered a wrestling royalty, and therefore if I had breached my contract for, say, missing a show in Sioux City, Iowa, I conceivably could have had all my royalties taken away from me. So maybe I was at the point of almost being paranoid, but I knew it was within their legal rights to keep that money from me, more money than I'd ever made wrestling. And it really, it kind of took away the joy of having the number one bestseller. Looking back on it, I don't think Vince McMahon ever would have done that to me, but it was knowing that it could be done that made it so difficult.
Now, so was the book published? And the book, by the way, for folks who don't remember, that was called Have a Nice Day.
Yes.
Was that published by the WWF?
They had a deal with Judith Regan, I had four books published with Regan Books, the two autobiographies and two children's books.
Right.
And, you know, when it came time to write this novel, Judith Regan made an offer on it. And when I called WWF to let them know that I was going to take the offer, things became a little tense. Like, I look at everything that happened before that day as being very, very good, and I look at everything that happened after that day as being kind of tough. And ultimately, I didn't take the offer because, of all reasons, I didn't know if I could actually write a novel. And I just felt really strange about accepting money for something that I didn't know if I could do. And then,
well, you didn't know that you could write an autobiography either, because they had hired someone to do it.
Yeah, they had hired a ghostwriter. And the truth is, if he had done a good job, I never would have crossed my mind, this whole writing thing. I was at the end of a 15 or 16 year wrestling career that had gone better than I could have hoped, and I had no idea what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And luckily, I read this man's work, a very nice man, by the way, and just thought, hey, I can do better than this. And I sat down up in the upper deck at the Tallahassee Civic Center one day in May of 99 and just started writing on legal pads. And that night I read it aloud to some of the wrestlers, and they loved it. They were laughing, and they said, this is great. So that was all the encouragement I needed.
So obviously it's worked out well. Did the WWF do they have any kind of retirement program for their wrestlers?
Oh, I was just asked about that on the sports show. They don't, and it's one of the sad parts of wrestling in that there is no union. I think we should be covered in a just world. We should be covered under the SAG or AFTRA umbrella because we are essentially television performers. We do live shows also, but the bread and butter of professional wrestling are television shows and pay-per-view shows. And I've been told that, you know, in from the AFTRA point of view or the SAG point of view, there's just not enough of us to make it worth their while pursuing, which is kind of sad. So I'm a guy that fortunately does have a Screen Actors Guild card and an AFTRA card, but a lot of the guys are not so lucky. So they know that, first off, Vince McMahon will cover their injuries, but they also know that they need to save their money, because there will come a time when those checks stop and there is no retirement plan that kicks in.
Well, you talked about injuries, and you've had quite a few of them. Now, what happens if you become disabled permanently, and did the WWF pick up on those things?
My understanding is they take care of the guys for quite a while. That they've had a couple guys. Darren Drozdoff was paralyzed, and he, I believe, is still part of the company and does things for their website, and I believe he is still considered, an employed, part of the company.
Tell folks out there who are listening, who, obviously wrestling is quote unquote fake, it's scripted. It doesn't mean, though, that things don't go wrong. And tell folks about some of the injuries you've suffered in your career.
Oh man, it sounds cooler if someone else does it. But
I'll tell them that. This is some of the injuries that Mick has had in his career: 325 stitches, 8 concussions, a dislocated shoulder, 3 knee surgeries, a torn abdominal muscle, and a multitude of bone fractures, as well as the loss of 1 ear and 2 teeth.
Yeah.
What happened with the ear?
Oh, the ear was a kind of a unique incident in Munich, Germany, where I had a a move I would do or my head get caught up in the ropes. And I thought, oh, this is great because no one else would steal it. I wasn't the most athletically gifted of the performers, so I had to come up with creative ways of making the matches exciting. And this was very creative, and it was an incredible illusion of hanging by your head in entwined ring ropes, which can be very tight. And the reason no one did it is because it hurt a lot. And actually, you can cut out like 50 of those stitches because the ear that I lost probably had 50 stitches in it already. Wow. So I don't know if that counts if the body part that was stitched is no longer there.
Wow.
But on this night in Munich, Germany, the ropes were just too tight. They were actually elevator cables that with some rubber coating around it. And I just literally had to squeeze my head through those cables after it was entwined because I thought, I'm not going to be able to get out of here. And at that point, the ropes, which are pressing on the carotid arteries, would cut off the blood supply to the brain and it could lead to some, you know, pretty dire consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got out, my ear did not get out with me, so... That was one of the...
How did you react to that? I can't even imagine it.
Well, I'm lucky in that I didn't reach up. I actually reached up and felt the other ear, which needed 14 stitches also. And had I reached up and seen my ear, at that point it was hanging, it wasn't quite off, I don't know how I would have reacted, but we kept wrestling. I knew the ear was hurt and there was quite a bit of blood loss. And the ironic thing is, or the strange thing, is that if wrestling was a real sport, certainly they would blow a whistle and, you know, time out, and that would have been the end of the match. But because we do is kind of like strange performance art.
Right.
You just do the best you can to keep going. And we went going, you know, rumor has it, legend has it, that we went an extra 10 minutes. We actually went an extra maybe 2 minutes. And it was funny. It was like the thing that movies are made out of, in that two referees had been sent home, one due to a death in the family and one due to knee surgery. And so they had brought in a French referee who spoke no English. And so he picked up the ear, was not able to translate to us that he had the ear, handed it to a ring announcer who very gingerly tiptoed it backstage. And by the time I was done wrestling, it was already on ice in a plastic bag, but they were not able to reconnect it.
So I assume since plastic surgery has been developed that you've had something developed, or no?
No. You know, I could. At one point I was supposed to have surgery to fix it, and instead I, returned to the ring. And I think that wrestling fans are a forgiving group. Like, I think they can accept that I will wear a jacket and tie to talk to Katie Couric on the Today Show. They'll accept that, you know, not only have I done the autobiographies, but that I like to write and that I've done a novel. But I think if I were to show up one day with new front teeth and a new ear, that they would jump ship immediately. I think that would be too much for them to take.
Well, it's interesting to note the reaction that, you know, when you lose your front two teeth, and you know you say, oh my God, there's nothing worse than this. I'm going to look terrible. Then you have your wife tell you how wonderful you look. And in the book that you've written, the character, the lead character in the book, has a similar situation in that he feels like nobody. And then this beautiful, you know, homecoming queen, the girl there that falls in love with him, Terry, makes him feel kind of like your wife felt with you with the ear.
I hadn't thought of that, but that's probably subconsciously what I was thinking. And the way that they are introduced, or the way that they make their initial contact, stems from a true story when I was on the Howard Stern show. And I walked in, and Howard Stern was not a wrestling fan at all. He has since, you know, come to, you know, respect it at least. And I walked in, and he said, hey, Cactus Jack, here you're missing an ear. And I said, well, it's gone, Howard, but I don't really miss it. And he started laughing. So in the book, you know, there's a teacher, or the coach, who is a coach/history teacher who doesn't really know his history too well. And he was such a horrible character that when I rewrote it, I was going to make him look exactly like me so I could play him in a potential cinematic version. But he's kind of picking on the kid. Hey, Eddie, I hear you're missing an ear there. And then that's when he says, well, it's gone, but I don't miss it. And he hears this one loud laugh, and it's that beautiful girl sitting a couple rows behind him. And that's how they make initial contact. So, and that way, you know, having having had some strange life experiences, and especially being around a very wild, unusual cast of characters was really, a blessing for my writing.
Well, tell me a little bit about the children connection. You wrote two children's books.
Right.
And obviously, I would assume that you met a lot of kids like this kid when you were touring the country or whatever. Tell me a little bit about the connection there.
Well, I'm not sure if it had. I guess, from the abuse point of view, I'm looking at the kid, Andy, because he's so resilient and he's so optimistic in spite of what he's been through that even when people interpret the book as being dark, I say, yeah, it is dark, but really the point of the story is that his resiliency is the light at the end of that darkness. He is essentially me sitting at the table with my pen and paper, imagining that I was 17 and remembering what it felt like to not completely fit in with the world, but at the same time trying to imagine how I would have reacted had so many bad things happened to me. But I do think that working with kids has given me a sense of understanding and an empathy for what can go on in childhood, and I think in some way or form that will always make its way into my writing. Even the children's, the Christmas book was based on a special little kid I met who becomes, in that story, the special little boy who puts the spirit of Christmas back into a broken-hearted Santa Claus. So that was a direct example of a kid influencing me. But I think, these kids I've met along the way will influence me in subtle ways for a long time.
The book is a quick read. It's a great book to take to the beach, folks. And I love the writing in it. It's very humorous. You get your sense of humor fully intact after taking so many hits to the head.
Yeah, but, and that's part of the reason I decided to get out of wrestling. When I did the memoirs, I was like, where did this sense of recall come from? I was able to remember things that I hadn't consciously thought of in years. And I looked at it and I said, if you were to show a neurologist, or a brain surgeon, a tape of all of the shots I've taken of the head, they would say, this guy shouldn't even be coherent, let alone writing books. And so I saw that as, I did not want to press my luck. And that's about the time the book was published, I think October 23rd of 1999, and it was November 2nd when I had my big talk with Vince and told him that I thought I needed to retire.
What was his reaction to that speech?
A very understanding. Yeah. I told him, I was playing soccer with my kids, and I realized that unless they kicked that ball directly to me, that I wasn't going to be able to get to it because I had no lateral movement. I could barely bend up and down. I certainly couldn't jump. Anyone who saw me play basketball in high school knew I could never jump anyway. But he was very understanding. He even said, you've just had your last match. And then it turned out I wrestled a few more months and retired April 1st of 2000. But I'm glad, Mark, that you pointed out the sense of humor in the story, because some of the bad things that happened to this poor kid do tend to overshadow the joy for life that he has and the humor earlier in the book.
Well, there are some funny things. I mean, for instance, the scene where he meets Terry's mom and they're talking and he wants to talk to the father because he's a reverend.
Yeah.
And the mother says, well, he's meeting with Billy Graham. He says, oh, you mean the wrestler?
Yeah.
No. Billy Graham, the other Billy Graham. But I love that. That's really, in essence, the character.
Yeah. The dad is, I think, a really good character because he does come across as being the world's shallowest man early on.
Oh, yeah.
And then Andy kind of learns that his dad is more or less hiding in this protective, shallow cocoon he's made for himself, and that there's this very deep, very troubled person living in there. And when his dad makes a genuine attempt, to branch out, to show love and to accept love, he unfortunately doesn't react well to failure.
But no, he doesn't. No.
Yeah. And at that point, hopefully I'm not ruining it for people, but at that point he becomes a very bad dad.
He wasn't a good dad before.
No, he wasn't a good dad before, but he was showing potential, and there were some genuine bonding moments with the kid that I think were very touching. But ultimately, he's not the type of guy you'd want to grow up with.
Now, Mick, talk about the title. Where did that come from?
Tatum Brown, or as everybody's calling it, Tatum Brown, Had I known there'd be this confusion, you'd be talking to me about my new novel, Bob Brown. But Tietam is short for Antietam, which is the battlefield that represents the bloodiest single day in American history. Gettysburg was bloodier, but that took place over 4 days. And first of all, I just thought Tietam Brown, like it just hopped in my head. All of the Browns are descended from a soldier who died on that battlefield. And one of the themes that I thought would be central to the book that didn't quite come through, although there are a lot of other themes, I think, that do come through, one of the themes was that of history repeating itself. And I wanted to give this guy a name that, you know, for one person might honor, you know, be the paying tribute to a fallen soldier, but in the wrong person's hands, the name could be a living, breathing grudge, you know, that every day this guy wakes up and remembers, you know, the death in the family. And I see Tietam as a guy who, you know, despite his good qualities, ultimately lacks the ability to forgive, and that kind of shapes, you know, the tragic side of him.
Yeah, I agree with that. Forgiveness is also a part of the book as well, I think.
Yeah, that was my main theme, and I was fortunate to work with Victoria Wilson of Knopf, who has been there for 30 years. And among the many things she told me, she wouldn't tell me how to change the book. She just told me it had to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me that I would find ways, or she would help me find ways to change it. But she didn't. I had to come up with all the ideas, which didn't mean she was very helpful, because in the end it was a great journey of self-discovery for me. But one of the things she told me is that, you know, the reader needs to come to realizations themselves. You don't need to hit them over the head with what you think. Because to tell you the truth, you know, as a writer, you're not sure why you're writing what you're writing. And so forgiveness, the word itself, which was mentioned, you know, at least 100 times, became mentioned much less, maybe half a dozen times. But ultimately, if someone were to ask me what this book is about, like what is the main point, I would say, you know, forgiveness. And then the larger question is redemption possible for a person who lacks that ability to forgive.
Hmm. Now you have children, right?
Yes.
Any sons?
Yes, I have four children, and I have three sons, 11, 2, and 4 months.
Ah. Now, are they aware of your wrestling career?
Oh yeah. I was my 11-year-old's hero for many years, and then one day I came home and my posters were not on his wall anymore. And he had Michael Jordan up there instead. And, a tough day when you realize you're not your son's hero anymore.
Yeah, well, you know, be confident in the fact that my son's never had my picture on his wall.
But,
you know,
well, you know what's nice is the 2-year-old. He has no idea, you know, who I was or what I did. He just thinks that every father has their own action figure. You know?
I will tell you that my 11-year-old has your action figure.
All right.
And was quite stunned and very happy that I was actually going to speak to Mankind today.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Man, well, tell him I appreciate it. Tell him I'm sorry I'm using so many big words. Trust me, these big words are not in the book.
Hey, you know something? I got to tell you about the big words, because have you read the Harry Potter books at all?
There's a lot of big words.
A lot of big words in there. He just went through that whole book, and it's the best thing I've ever seen for boosting kids' vocabulary.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if Tietam... Well, first off, kids should...
No, I don't think Tietam's a kid's book, really.
But you know what? My feeling is, like, if I sat there with a thesaurus, you know, for my first book, Have a Nice Day, and I wish I'd read Stephen King's book on writing while I was reading that, because, you know, when he talks about dialogue attribution and the tendency for writers to overuse adverbs, he might as well have just been shouting at me, like, hey, cut it out, you know, because nobody said anything in my first book. They all laughed it or chuckled it or yelled it, you know. And I think at one point I actually said, like, geez, that was some match, he chuckled laughingly or something like that. So when it came time, I read that book, and I had the manuscript for my second memoir on the table, and I literally went through and, like, changed 300 things right away. But, of course, for anyone who reads J.K. Rowling's, J.K. is, or Joe, I guess they call her, she's big on the adverb, and it hasn't seemed to have harmed her career at all.
No, not at all.
But you're right. There are, not only are there a lot of made-up words, there are a lot of difficult words.
Yeah. But it's this is a good book. I like this book.
Oh, it's
Cheatham Brown is a good book. Let's boost this book.
Yeah, we don't need to give J.K. Rowling any.
No, she's got enough help already.
She's okay, I think.
And folks, for all the kids that are wrestling fans, you can just buy the book for the picture in the back and put that up on the wall, you know. And I understand you're on a tour right now promoting it.
Yeah.
You're in Atlanta right now.
Yes, this is a pretty ambitious tour. I saw that I had 12 dates lined up, and I called the publicist, and I said, you know, I'll drive to most of these. And I said, I don't live very expensively on the road, so I'll do more if you want. So next thing I knew, we had 20 dates, and then Canada, we added a couple in Canada. And then England called and said, hey, remember you said you'd be willing to tour to promote the book? I was like, oh, I kind of forgot about that. So I did 5 days over in England. So by the time this tour is done, we'll have done 25 book signings / readings, which is new for me. And I'll probably be sick of talking about the book and never want to see it again. But thankfully, I haven't reached that point yet.
Are you going to continue the same character in the next book?
Yeah, well, you want me to use my same joke I used on Matt Lauer?
Sure, go ahead.
He said, so Knopf is awaiting another book, and I said, yes, Tatum Brown and the Order of the Phoenix, at which point Katie Couric off-screen laughed uproariously. And I thought, how cool is it to be able to make Katie laugh with a stupid joke like that? But I don't know if I would continue it. I mean, if it's one of those things where people... really, you know, want it, and I think there will be, I don't know how many people will buy the book, but I think there will be a percentage of those who buy it who will literally love it, you know, who will consider it like a good friend to them. And who knows, you know, I love the characters, and I don't know if you could tell or not, but I was, you know, kind of smitten with my own female... female creation, Terry.
Yeah, I think you like Terry, yeah.
Yeah, and from what I can tell, like, the wives seem to be okay with the idea of somebody falling for a fictional creation. Like, there's no apparent, you know, rule against that. So I would love to recreate, you know, to bring life back to them. But I have a manuscript I just turned in that has nothing to do with these characters and is like a period piece in the Bronx in the mid-60s through the late 70s.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, hope so.
You know, has anybody pitched you yet on movies for any of the books that you've done?
Yeah. Well, you know what? Have a Nice Day would have made a good movie, and I think it lost its time, you know, when wrestling was so hot that, you know, that everyone wanted a piece of it.
Right.
And I would hear things about people being interested, and the latest one is Will Sasso, the actor.
Mm-hmm.
Who apparently, you know, not only does great impersonations, but is a pretty good dramatic actor. He loves the book and wants to make it a movie, and he, you know, he wants to play me, and apparently does a better imitation of me than I do. but I'm having a meeting in Hollywood next week with somebody who really likes Tatum. I know, you know, a couple of studios saw it and said this is a little dark for us, and maybe it doesn't have you know, Will Smith July 4th blockbuster written all over it, but. My feeling is that an actor will want to play the role of Tatum Brown, and you know, and that it will see you know, see the light of cinematic day in a smaller form, you know. But I think ultimately it will, somebody would really make a great role out of it.
And of course, Mark Snyder with his dirty mind here is thinking, we should get together and review who's going to play Terry.
Oh,
be a good addition, so you can actually make your dreams come true.
Oh, but I think that unwritten rule about falling in love with your fictional creation does not cross over to a real live actress playing that creation.
No, but it does allow you to at least go to the meeting and see if the fantasy woman actually exists.
Oh,
and if she walks in the door, you can say, that's Terry right there.
Well, you know what? I wouldn't want to be a pain in the neck and say some actor, you know, say a director wants to do this. I wouldn't pretend to tell him how to do his job, but I would invoke the no Eddie Furlong clause so that Eddie Furlong couldn't play Andy. And I would insist on letting me take a stab at being the coach.
There you go. See, there's another future job for Mick Foley.
I was actually going to rewrite the coach so he resembled me. Instead of having, you know, these broad shoulders, I was going to give him a set of love handles, and you know, and I could have slipped into that role comfortably.
Okay, you're going to go back to the gym.
I know. I don't want to.
Well, you know, that's part of life. The book is called Tatum Brown. It's by Mick Foley from Knopf Publishers. It's available right now all over the place. You can go on the internet at Amazon.com or go to your nearby friendly bookstore and get this book. It's a great book. It's fun. And there's another side. For all those folks out there who think that that wrestlers are big, dumb idiots, Mick Foley comes along, intelligent guy, writing really funny, good stuff. And I expect to see some a lot more stuff down the road from you.
Yeah, I'm hoping, you know, that this one will do well enough to where I can say, okay, this is what I do for a living, because I have a lot of stories in mind and really enjoy telling them. And for anyone who says, hey, you know, they'd like to see my book readings, which I do try to, make original for every group, the tour schedule is listed on either aaknopf.com or mickfoley.com.
Let's promote mickfoley.com.
Yeah, and mickfoley.com has excerpts from the book that I picked out and think readers would find interesting.
What I'm going to do is, next to this interview at pmpnetwork.com, we will put a link to mickfoley.com. Maybe mickfoley.com should put a link to the interview on pmpnetwork.com so your fans can listen to you on the
Let me write that down. pmp.com.
PMP, like Peter Mary, PMP, Peter Mary Paul Network.com.
Network.com. All right.
Yeah. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Yes, thank you very much, and I'm flattered to be asked to be on this program.
Well, I'm flattered that you came on.
All right.
And we'll go play with your wrestling figure now. I'm going to steal it from my son. Take care.
All right, thanks, Mark.
Bye-bye.